Well, brethren, a number of years ago, I heard that phrase, the miracle worker, and thought it would make a great title for a discourse where we would review some of the miracles of Jesus. And I mentioned that to my wife, Sister Cheryl, and she asked me if I was going to speak on Ann Sullivan and Helen Keller, and I had no idea why she asked me that. And she said, well, that's the name of the movie that was made about their lives. And, of course, that intrigued me. I immediately went, watched the movie, and I found some wonderful human interest elements in that story. And we're going to look at that story as a real-life example that I felt contained some profound insights into a mind that was in utter darkness and isolation, but that could be brought back to enlightenment and reach its full potential, not in spite of its physical deficiencies, but in large measures because of them. She probably became a greater person because of the struggles she had to go through to get there. You know, the world is currently like that blind little deaf girl. But like Helen Keller, man's journey through life is creating an endless source of lessons that will form part of the world's memory for eternity to come. Memory is so important. We know that mankind will reach its full potential, again, not in spite of the permission of evil, but because of the benefits that permission of evil will bring to the world of mankind. Well, in this story, due to some illness, they haven't identified specifically, but they think it might have been scarlet fever or meningitis. Helen Keller lost both her hearing and her eyesight when she was only 19 months old. As a young girl, she was described as almost a feral child. Did I miss this part? Oh, yeah. The phrase the miracle worker was actually coined by Mark Twain to describe the work of Ann Sullivan with Helen Keller's. And really, in many ways, it was nothing short of a miracle. And I, like I said, in some ways parallels the work that God is doing with mankind. But as a young girl, Helen was described as almost a feral child. Now, a feral child lives isolated from human contact from a very young age, has no experience of human care or social interaction because of their deficiencies, and don't understand human language. Helen Keller, however, had loving parents, but parents who just did not know how to interact or deal with such challenging problems, and so they just let Helen do whatever she wanted. She would kick and punch anyone who would try to make her do something that she didn't want to do, and so she became really more like an animal than a child. This is how one website describes her. Helen was an unruly, spoiled child who tyrannized the household with her temper tantrums. Now, if you've ever seen that movie about her life, you may remember one scene where she's feeling her way around the dinner table as the family is eating there. And she would take anything off of anyone's plate that she could feel that she wanted and put it in her mouth and eat it there. And it became the accepted practice at dinner time for her. And it just kept the calm in the family. Otherwise, she would have these tantrums. As long as Helen got what she wanted, she wouldn't disturb them. Now, dealing with her behavior finally became so difficult for her parents that they considered putting her in an asylum for the mentally deficient. Now, when she was 2 years old, her mother had read an account written by Charles Dickens of the successful education of another blind and deaf child some 50 years earlier, and she was inspired by that story. And so she had her husband take Helen to see an eye, ear, nose, and throat specialist, who then put them in contact with Alexander Graham Bell, who was working with children at that time. So we've got some famous names here that we're talking about. Well, eventually, he couldn't help her, apparently. They were directed to an Institute for the Blind in Boston. The director of the school asked a former student by the name of Ann Sullivan, who had now become a teacher, if she would take Helen on as a special project. Now, Ann had her own problems to deal with. It says, afflicted with trachoma, Ann had begun to lose her eyesight due to corneal scarring at age 3 and was virtually blind by the age of 5. When she was 8, her mother died of tuberculosis. And when she was 10, her father, an abusive alcoholic, abandoned both her and her younger brother at a poorhouse. Her brother, also suffering from tuberculosis, soon died. Through various benefactors, Ann received a series of operations on her eyes. Eventually, her sight was restored enough that she could read for short periods. And when you see other pictures of her in the daylight, she's always wearing dark sunglasses, not to be cool, but because the light really affected her eyes. Ann was very intelligent, and she was determined, a young lady. And so she accepted that position of being Helen's teacher when Helen was 6 years old. At that first dinner of the family that Anne attended, she watched in horror at the way Helen was allowed to help herself from everyone's plate. And she demanded to know, why are you letting her do this? And they said, it just keeps the peace. Well, Anne then made a simple yet profound statement. She said, if you want to help your daughter, you have to discipline her. But her parents didn't think that Helen was intelligent enough to understand what discipline was. Anne got up from the table. She took the food out of Helen's hands and even out of her mouth. She pulled up a chair and she threw Helen into the chair. And you can imagine the brawl that resulted from a spoiled child being treated that way. It was the first time in Helen's life that her behavior had been challenged. And so an unbelievable scene of chaos followed. But Anne would not back down. She demanded that everyone leave the room with her alone with Helen. She locked the two doors of the dining room and proceeded to force Helen to sit and eat with a spoon. Every time she put a spoon in Helen's hand, the spoon went flying across the room. So spoon after spoon went flying. Well, this created a long, exhausting struggle for both of them. Helen was not going to give in to Anne's control. She would run around the room, try to get away, but the doors were locked, so Anne would keep catching her. She would catch her, bring her back to the table, sit her down in the chair, and put another spoon in her hand, which, of course, Helen would spit out the food that she put there. Well, if you watch that chaotic scene, the movie graciously cuts away from that. And the next scene shows Helen's mother outside on the porch, waiting and listening to the commotion inside. Anne and Helen finally stumble out of the house, exhausted and ragged, and then she said this to Helen's mother. She ate from her own plate with a spoon, and she folded her own napkin. The room is a wreck, but the napkin is folded. And of course, the mother couldn't believe it. They had never been able to get through to Helen to teach her anything. They just didn't know how. And so this was the inauspicious beginning of one of the great human dramas of the education of a mind that was just as blind and deaf as her natural senses. Anne was to discover that Helen's mind was not deficient like her parents thought. In fact, she was very intelligent, but somehow Anne had to communicate with Helen, and because of her disabilities and awful behavior, communication was almost impossible. But Anne was determined, and she started using sign language, but not the usual way because Helen couldn't see, and so she would do sign language in her hand. But Helen, of course, didn't understand what any of that meant. Now, there's one scene in the movie when Helen's mother saw Anne signing in Helen's hand, and she asked, "What are you doing?" And she says, "Well, I'm spelling out words." And the mother says, "Well, does she understand?" And Anne said, "Oh, no, she will have to understand what words are first." "Well, when will she learn that?" asked the mother. And Anne responded, "It will take at least a million words." What a challenge. What a noble person Anne Sullivan was to make the commitment that she did. You know, Anne Sullivan was only 20 years old when she began working with Helen. But I think maybe her youth was part of her strength, that she was determined that there's no obstacles that you can't fight through if you're determined enough. I think losing both senses at such a young age took so much away from Helen Keller. Now, at one point, Helen's father was having a conversation with Anne. And I want to read you a couple of sentences because Anne makes another profound statement. No, not yet. After some initial success, at controlling Helen's behavior, her father came to her with her first month's salary, and he said, "This doesn't pay our debt for what you've done for Helen." And this was Anne's response. "I've taught her one thing. No, don't do this, don't do that. I want to teach her what language is. I know without it to do nothing but obey is no gift. Obedience without understanding is a blindness too. Simply going on doing what I've done and have faith that inside she's waiting like a water underground. I don't want her to just obey. To let her have her way is being alive to her." Brethren, that description of Anne's vision for Helen Keller is an amazing description of why God has permitted evil to come into this world. Obedience without understanding is a blindness too. Adam and Eve were told not to eat of one tree, a simple command. Shouldn't have had any problem doing that. But they were blind to the reason why. They didn't understand that God would always have their best interests at heart, no matter what anyone else would say or what the immediate circumstances might look like. And because of their mental blindness, their lack of understanding about God, their disobedience led to severe consequences. When Anne Sullivan said to Helen's mother, "If you want to help your daughter, you have to discipline her." My goodness, that also describes God's wisdom in being a good father in disciplining his children. Although Helen's parents loved her, they just didn't know how to be good parents because they felt sorry for her and they didn't want to do what was needed for her to do. God wants every individual in this world to understand the principles of a holy life. He wants them to do right and good because they see the benefit in those things. Blind obedience might be okay for a child, but in the end, it's not the right reason for our actions. On the other hand, the love of righteousness brings consequent blessings. When Anne Sullivan said to have her way as being alive to her, she was making another profound statement. In other words, with understanding comes the most beneficial exercise of free will. Isn't that amazing? When mankind is properly enlightened to the principles of God, they will be able to choose to live righteous lives, and sin will not tempt them anymore. But when free will is exercised without the proper enlightenment from God, it just can't choose the proper way to life. And that's where Adam and Eve were. Well, only after a short time at the Keller home, Anne thought that she had to get Helen away from her family. They were just undoing everything she was trying to do with Helen. And at first, Helen's father resisted. He wanted to keep her there, but they had a cottage on their property. And he said, "I'll give you 2 weeks alone with her. And after 2 weeks, you have to come back. And if there's been no progress, you're going to have to leave and we'll go back to the way we were living." Well, after 2 weeks, they came back and Helen's behavior had improved so much. They were so thrilled that they had a special dinner and they made all of Helen's favorite foods. But at that dinner, Helen did an interesting thing. First, she drops her napkin on the floor. And Anne thought, well, it was just a slip. I'll pick it up for her. And then she dropped it again. And Anne picked it up again. And then Helen began eating with her hands. You see, she was testing her parents to see if they would be more lenient like they had been, more lenient than Anne Sullivan would have allowed her. And of course, they were. They said, "Oh, we're so glad to have her back with us. What harm would it do to let her have her way just this once?" But of course, Anne was furious. "You're going to undo everything I've done with Anne." And then she made another profound statement. She said, "She will live up to just what you demand of her." Even after those 2 weeks of enforced discipline, Helen wanted to go back to her old habits. And brethren, there again is a microcosm of what may happen in the little season at the end of the millennium. After 1,000 years of discipline, there will be likely some individuals who want to go back to their old ways. We know that the Lord is going to rule the kingdom with a rod of iron, and people will be forced to obey. But we also know that at the end of the millennium, the little season will be the world's final test. And some scriptures indicate that the ancient worthies may be taken off the scene, and the rules apparently relaxed. And that might create opportunities for disobedience. Certain people may see this apparent power vacuum as their chance to do wrong. Maybe someone will simply drop a napkin, do some little thing that they know is wrong, just to see if there will be discipline. And then maybe they will do something a little worse, just to see maybe the rules are being relaxed. Those who do that, it will be obvious that they just didn't get the point of the kingdom. God's ultimate goal for mankind is not to demand obedience. It's about teaching people to want to do good because of its inherent blessings. That goal is so much more challenging than demanding obedience, isn't it? But God is determined to teach the world that the true meaning of life can only be found on a higher and nobler plane than most people are living on. I want to go back to the Helen Keller story. The turning point for her happened just after she and Anne Sullivan had returned from their 2 weeks of isolation, and they were at that dinner table where Helen had tested her parents' resolve. Anne was determined not to allow that to happen. And when she started eating with her hands, Anne grabbed the food from her. As you might expect, Helen threw another tantrum. She found a pitcher of water that was on the table, and she threw it at Anne, and Anne was doused. And Anne was so angry that she dragged Helen outside to the water pump just to make her refill that pitcher. And I'm going to show you a few minutes of that scene from the movie because I found it very moving. I hope this doesn't offend anyone, but I found this section so incredibly moving and powerful. And so before we show that, I want you to close your eyes for a moment. And you're still going to see light, even with your lights closed, with your eyes closed. But imagine complete darkness. And then imagine no sounds, not a whisper, not a tone, anything. Complete darkness and complete silence. Here's that scene. We turn the volume up a little bit.
All right. Come. No, she's not here, Pop. W-A-T-E-R, water. It has a name. W-A-T. Yes. Oh, my dear. Round. Yes.
Now, looking back on this scene years later, this is what Helen Keller wrote. She said, "I stood still, my whole attention fixed on the motions of her fingers. Suddenly, I felt a misty consciousness as of something forgotten, a thrill of returning thought. And somehow the mystery of language was revealed to me. I knew that that W-A-T-E-R meant the wonderful, cool something that was flowing over my hand. The living word awakened my soul and gave it light, hope, set it free." Helen learned 30 new words that first day, and in the next six months, she learned some 350 new words. And for me, one of the highlights was when Helen came over to Aunt Sullivan, and for the first time, she wanted to know who she was. And of course, Helen said, Anne said that I'm the teacher. You notice that Helen then went over to her mother and found the two keys in her mother's pocket. Well, she knew they were there because when they came back from the cottage, that was the first thing she did. She found the door, she took the keys out of the door, and she put them in her mother's pocket so she wouldn't have to be stuck in that room again with Aunt Sullivan. And so now, where do I see that? But now, after her mind was open, she takes the keys and she gives them to Anne as if to say, "Now I understand, and now I won't fight you anymore." I wanted to show you the very end of the movie where Helen found Anne sitting on the porch. Now, prior to their breakthrough, they had been mortal enemies, as you can imagine. But now that sweet moment when she sits on Anne's lap and she kisses her. Anne was then finally able to sign that I love Helen. She couldn't do that before. Brethren, how different than their first encounter, now that Helen understood that Anne Sullivan had her best interests at heart right from the beginning. Brethren, this story makes me think of how many times these moments of recognition will occur in the kingdom. People who hated Christ, those who persecuted the saints, will have a change of heart when they understand who Christ really is. And even when some may fight tooth and nail against the enforced rules of the kingdom, at some point they will have their minds enlightened and they will see the value of what the Lord was at first demanding of them. Then they will turn to the Lord in their own personal aha moment, as Brother Larry talked about yesterday, but now on a grander scale than the ones and twos we might have today. And she will have that feeling. And the world may say something like this: "So you're the teacher. You're the one with the keys of discipline that taught me to do good. Thank you for not giving up on me. Thank you for having the wisdom to know what I needed to be complete and find my own meaning in life." The psalmist said, "Kiss the Son, lest he be angry and ye perish from the way. When his wrath is kindled but a little, blessed are all they that put their trust in him." Helen now had complete trust in Anne. Brethren, think of what you and I have been called to do. We can be part of the Anne Sullivans of this world someday. She understood Helen's struggle because she had struggled herself. Every experience of our lives is designed to teach us sympathy for the struggling world, to understand them, to know when discipline will be required, and to rejoice when they come to the light and the discipline won't be needed anymore. I think it'll be a greater work than any of us can possibly imagine. In the case of Helen Keller, was it a miracle that this animal-like child could eventually connect with the outside world, become a famous author and lecturer? Not really. It wasn't a miracle. It was the result of the tremendous perseverance by her teacher. It was Anne's belief that Helen had great potential if only she could learn to see without using her eyes and hear without using her ears. As we look at the world today, we also see great potential. Now, the scriptures call this world the present evil world, and that certainly is appropriate. But, brethren, there's also great potential in this world. Sometimes the good gets drowned out by the evil. Sometimes the noble get trampled by the greedy. And sometimes those with essentially good hearts are quiet and go unnoticed. But God knows the potential that's there. And the kingdom is designed to perfect what in many cases simply lies dormant. I think we all want to be part of that work, don't we? The principle at the root of the permission of evil is described in Proverbs. My son, do not reject the discipline of the Lord or loathe his reproof. For whom the Lord loves, he reproves, even as a father corrects his son in whom he delights. How blessed is the man who finds wisdom and the man who gains understanding. In the New Testament, Paul quotes this passage, and after quoting it, he adds this. All discipline for the moment seems not to be joyful, but sorrowful. Yet to those who have been trained by it afterwards, it yields the peaceable fruit of righteousness. I love that last phrase, the peaceable fruit of righteousness. What a wonderful goal for God's kingdom, to plant that fruit in every heart. There's no question that Anne Sullivan must have experienced a great sense of satisfaction in her work as she watched Helen Keller mature and grow into her potential. And I wonder what satisfaction Jesus must have felt as he comforted those who mourned, as he healed the sick and raised the dead. And of course, he was the real miracle worker. Matthew 9:3 tells us how Jesus felt when he saw the condition of the people. It says, as he looked at the vast crowds, he was deeply moved with pity for them, for they were as bewildered and miserable as a flock of sheep with no shepherd. In Matthew, the 12th chapter, it says that large crowds followed Jesus, and he healed them all. And then in verse 20, we're given a description of Jesus' gentle touch. It says, a battered reed he will not break off, and a smoldering wick he will not put out until he leads forth justice to victory. And in his name, the Gentiles will hope. And brethren, that's a beautiful way of describing the care that Jesus felt for others, especially those suffering. A battered reed he will not break off. Now, a battered or bruised reed represents the poor and the oppressed. Jesus did not reject those who were feeble and destitute, but he encouraged them. He wanted to raise them up. He looked at people through merciful eyes and not critical eyes. The next phrase has a similar meaning when it says, a smoldering wick he will not put out. When the light in someone's heart is being extinguished, Jesus wants to encourage their faith and their hope to burn again. Isn't that a lovely way of saying that the Lord will not dismiss us if we're struggling with something? If our faith at times is like a smoldering wick, just barely surviving, it says he will not put it out, but he will give us experiences meant to draw us back if we're open to it. And I think that shows us how much the Lord wants us to succeed in the narrow way. As long as our faith isn't completely gone, as long as there's a faint flicker, the Lord will do what he can to reignite it, but we have to be open to it. When Jesus healed someone, there was something even more important to him than making them physically better. And of course, he was interested in restoring their spiritual eyesight, their faith. We see that in a miracle he performed for a young boy. You remember the boy had been possessed by a demon from an early age, and the father was naturally beside himself with worry. And he came to Jesus and he said this, if thou canst do anything, have compassion on us and help us. Jesus said to him, if thou canst believe, all things are possible to him that believeth. And straightway the father of the child cried out and said with tears, Lord, I believe. Help thou mine unbelief. This was an honest man. He didn't try to cloak his real feelings. He believed, maybe because he saw Jesus doing miracles for other people, and yet there was part of him that maybe wasn't sure that Jesus would do it for him. Well, here's a perfect example of Jesus not putting out a smoldering wick. How much do you think that man struggled with faith after Jesus cast the demon out of his son? Do you ever find yourself thinking that same thing? Lord, I believe, but help my unbelief. Do you ever think that the kingdom message, you know, it's just too good to be true? or feel that I'm just not good enough to be part of the high calling? Well, brethren, I'll tell you, I find that the memories of past experiences are invaluable in overcoming any of those doubts that might creep into our lives. And I try to recall the times that I clearly saw the Lord's hand in an experience I had, or when he helped me with something, when he gave me strength through a trial, when he delivered me from an experience, when he gave me a special blessing. Those memories are vital to our spiritual growth and stimulating to our faith. So record them, remember them, treasure them, because they're the foundations of your faith. Faith is built through life's experiences, and we draw strength from all our memories. In Matthew 9:35, we're told that Jesus went to every town and city, teaching in their synagogues and proclaiming the gospel of the kingdom and healing every kind of disease and every kind of sickness. You know, the records of the healings and miracles we have, I think, are just a touch of what actually happened back then. And so Jesus was teaching about his kingdom and connecting it to his miraculous power of healing. And Jesus knew that when he healed someone or raised them from the dead, they would get sick again and they would die again. And so I believe that for him, his miracles were just small samples of what was to come on a much larger scale in the kingdom when there would be an end to those things permanently. Now, just briefly looking, the miracles of Jesus fall into three categories. He performed physical healings, including raising the dead. He exhibited control over nature, like calming the stormy sea, walking on water, multiplying food, turning water into wine. And of course, he had power over demons. And so this power indicates that he would be given complete authority upon his resurrection and would be fully demonstrated in the kingdom. Everything pertaining to humanity and more is subject to his control. Aren't you glad for that? That someone like him has ultimate power and control of this world, not fallen human beings. After his resurrection, he said, "All authority has been given to me in heaven and earth." And so in a small way, his miracles demonstrated what that authority will entail. The satisfaction that Jesus must have felt when he helped someone, when he did a good work, is something I think that we can each have today on a grander scale in the future. Brethren, someday we will have the privilege of not only healing the physical wounds of mankind, but even better, of opening their spiritual eyes of a world that doesn't see, but a world that has great potential. And so for us, our work is to keep learning, to see things the Lord's way, to hear his instructions, so that someday we will be qualified to help others. For the world, mankind, Malachi said, the Son of Righteousness will arise with healing in his wings. And then Isaiah adds these inspiring words, then the eyes of the blind shall be opened, and the ears of the deaf shall be unstopped. Then shall the lame man leap as a hart, and the tongue of the dumb shall sing. Think there'll be any miracles in the kingdom? Oh, man, on so many different levels. But there will also be a lot of hard work and discipline and instruction and profound moments of enlightenment. The wisdom of the great teacher and miracle worker will prevail, and the blind and deaf world will be made whole, finally reaching its full potential. To this end, we pray, may thy kingdom come.